welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest from the band Built to Spill, from the band Tree People, Doug March is here on the show, and this is one that has been years in the making, and believe me, it is worth it. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian. There is a Facebook page, a TikTok page, a YouTube page, an Instagram page. I mentioned that already. All of those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on their respective platforms, Turned Out of Punk. And you can get in touch with the show that way. If you want to support the show by telling all your friends, every single last one, about this podcast here where they talk to people about punk music. And you can spread the word that way. Speaking of spreading the word, spread the word that I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. There are some new records that we have coming out, constantly churning out new records. We've got some tour dates, including with the legendary, the originals, like truly the originals of the punk rock world, The Damned. And we also will be going back to Europe to play some shows, and you can find out all that information over at fuckedup.cc. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, this one has been years in the making. Doug March is on the show today from Built to Spill, from the super underrated Tree People, and a fantastic band, Tree People, and a band that I've only really come to truly appreciate, I think, through doing this podcast over the last few years. Well, it's been more than a few years at this point. I had some records by them, but only when you kind of put them in the context that you get from talking to people that were around back then do you really understand how important that band was. Doug is, of course, an unbelievable songwriter that has touched the hearts and minds of an entire generation through his records with Built to Spill. Built to Spill, of course, have a brand new, fantastic album, keeping in their tradition of unbelievable records, When the Wind, which came out, I guess it's almost a year old. Just over a year old. So happy birthday, When the Wind. And to celebrate that, they will be going on tour throughout the month of October and into November. You can find out more information at builttospill.com. But that's not why you're here. Well, you know, you're here to find out about that sort of stuff. But you're also here to hear Doug talk about, you know, brotherhood. That's why we're all here. We want to hear these incredible songwriters talk about straight edge hardcore bands from the late 80s. That's why we do this thing. All right, so I'm not going to ramble on anymore and let you sit back and listen to this thing in 1 second. I first met Doug at Sled Island, as we talk about on this show, and knew then that one day this would be a doozy of an episode if it ever happened, and now it finally has. I think that's it. I think I don't have anything more to kind of tell you about. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Doug March on Turned Out of Punk. Doug, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, fuck. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think the last time I spoke to you was at a Sled Island Festival, and we talked briefly about how you used to be into punk and hardcore back in the day, but that you were leaving. And so I didn't get a chance to punish you on it, and now, oh my God, I got you completely at my mercy. Oh, hello. Hello. My cat might come in too.
She has a little bit of a choking situation. She gets a little breathing problem, but she didn't interrupt us too much.
No, we just got a new cat ourselves after our last one passed away just after the pandemic. So it's,
sorry to hear that.
Yeah, no, it's great to have a new cat, obviously. Miss the old one, certainly every day, but at the same time, just having another, oh man, I'm a cat person.
I'll take any animal. I'm not a reptile guy, but I guess I'm sure if I had one, I'd become a reptile guy.
Well, that being said, we also used to have two dogs, so as I'm sure if we get two more dogs or another dog, I will become a dog person as well again. So it's just, I'm very much, just any animal. But now we got to talk about punk, and I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Doug, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
The first time I, what about the first time I came across it?
Do you remember? Yeah. Do you remember the first time you came across it?
Yeah. I think the first time I heard about punk was, I had an older sister. It was like 8 years older than me. And, she went off to college, and, this was maybe like 1980, something like that. And, 81. And I remember her telling me about punks. Like, she saw some punks at college, kind of told me about them. And it was like, it was fine. It wasn't, you know, she didn't seem to care either way about them. And then next was my best friend in junior high school, Brett Nelson, who went on to play bass for Built to Spill for the majority of our career. He's not in the band now, but he was like the first kind of like new waver in Twin Falls, Idaho. He had like a Flock of Seagulls haircut in seventh grade, and no one, you know, there was no one doing anything like that. And he's also kind of like a, he was kind of like a, like everyone liked him and stuff. He didn't get any shit for it, you know, he was just kind of whatever. But then he like, he went and bought a Sex Pistols cassette, and that was the first time I heard punk.
And what did you make of it the first time hearing it? Like, were you already kind of like a rock and roll fan at this point? And were you like aware of them?
Yeah, I was, I don't know if I was aware of them. I don't know if that was the first I'd even heard of them. I think their name kind of shocked me a little bit as a, whatever, 12-year-old or something. I was a little bit taken aback by it. I was kind of disappointed. I thought the music just kind of sounded like Chuck Berry or something a little bit. Like, it just sounded like distorted Chuck Berry. I kind of expected it to be like weirder in a way or something, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's just like, well, he's just singing so horribly. It's kind of, you know, I remember not really liking it much, but kind of it growing on me a little bit. Even, well, he and I would, like, we're best friends. We'd like, he was into heavy metal, or I was into heavy metal, like crappy heavy metal, like Ozzy and Scorpions and Def Leppard and stuff, like pop metal, you know, early pop metal in the whatever, early 80s. And he was in the new wave, Flock Seagulls and so on. But we'd, you know, we're such best friends. We'd like take turns listening to one song off our new cassette for each other. You know, we'd like try to like see the best we could in each other's music and stuff. Yeah, that was my introduction to punk.
And so where did you kind of, like, what was kind of local music like in Twin Falls? Like, were there any, like, are there any local new wave bands around that time?
No way. Yeah, nothing at all. Brett was like, Brett's plan, like, right when I met him was like, I'm going to, he played keyboards. And I was like, I couldn't, you know, I'd never known anyone that, like, you know, had a synthesizer, you know, play with that thing forever, just making weird sounds. He was the first person that was, like, into doing stuff like that. And he's like, when I get out of high school, or maybe I don't even know if I want to graduate from high school, his plan was to move to England and start a punk band.
Oh, that's like, awesome.
I don't think we even thought that you could do it, you know, if you weren't in England. That's where all his favorite bands were, you know.
But I don't know, it's funny. I was talking to this guy, Aryan, who's from Indonesia and plays in this huge hardcore band out there. And he was saying how hearing the Sex Pistols and how shitty Johnny Rotten's voice sounded was like, oh my God, I can do this. Cause like prior to that, you mentioned like, even like Ozzy, there's like such a range happening and such a, like, sort of a professional vocal versus John Lydon, which is like, oh shit, I can do this.
Oh yeah, totally. That all came later for me. Totally. At this point, I didn't even play an instrument. This was before I even knew how to play a guitar or anything. So I wasn't really on that music path with him. I was a listener at that point, and I was going to be a visual artist at that point in my life. Ever since I was a little kid, I drew. So I was going to be an architect, because I was told that that's what you do if you want to make a living off drawing, is you become an architect. I didn't know anything about it or anything, but that was sort of what I thought my life was going to lead to. Or maybe at that point I started getting into comics, I thought maybe I could go in that direction.
So where'd you kind of go musically after hearing the Sex Pistols? Like, where were you picking up music from?
Well, my big thing was like, I felt like I was doing all that metal stuff, you know, it's not even metal. I don't know what you call that stuff now. it's so like poppy, it's hardly metal, but hard rock or whatever. Heavy metal. That's what it was. Instead of metal, it was heavy metal. I felt like my big transition was David Bowie, because he was kind of like, you know, I heard like some Ziggy Stardust thing. I got like a greatest hits, and it was like, it really kind of took you from hard rock, you know, Ziggy Stardust or whatever, to whatever, new wave and stuff. And he kind of opened my mind up a lot. And then the other thing was REM. I saw REM on David Letterman, you know, on their first record. And David Letterman said that they were like the number one college music band. And that really impressed me, that college people, you know, they were number one with college. And they sounded cool to me. It sounded so different and weird. And this all kind of happened at a time, at a pivotal time, when I moved from Twin Falls to Boise. Boise's not a big city, but compared to Twin Falls, it's totally big. And it was right when like a month before I started high school. So it was like a big time anyway, you know, being that age, 14, about to become a serious teenager. So those things. And so I had this month off too, between moving to Boise and starting high school. I didn't know anyone, didn't have anything to do. And that's when I learned how to play a guitar. And that's when music started to take over for me. And then there was a college radio station there, or here, I'm in Boise now. And they played some things. I heard the Smiths, heard some other kinds of things. And then in high school, there was already a punk scene here in Boise in whatever that year that was. I guess that was 1984. And there were some punk bands. And in high school, I met some kids, told me about the punk hardcore bands. And within a few months, I was at a hardcore show.
So I guess believe me, I want to dive into that in 1 second, but going back before that, you know, REM, it's interesting how you have these major jumping on points for people getting into underground culture. You know, like the Devo playing on SNL is such a huge one. And, you know, you know, like the later on, I guess Nirvana playing on TV shows, but like REM, I think as well, is such an interesting gateway point, because it's the birth of, I guess, what would be called college rock, but ultimately alternative music, and everything kind of starts with like the sort of REM explosion that happens. And so many people that wind up doing things in music get into music through REM making these appearances on TV and just, you know, kind of making that outreach.
For sure. Yeah. It was, and you know, that was a time too, where, you know, if you had music, you had like, you know, obviously there was no streaming. You had your records, your tapes, whatever. And it took a while to get a tape, you know, it took a couple weeks or something to save up the money to go buy yourself a tape. And so those, you know, they were so important. You listen to it so much and just drank it in so hard, you know?
Yeah. So you mentioned getting into high school and meeting these kids that are into the hardcore scene. Is that like State of Confusion at that point, or like is Septic Totally. Death still around, or
Septic Death was gone. Mm. It was State of Confusion. Yep.
That record's ripping.
All they the records. I'm glad. That's really sweet to hear. I so wish that record had been recorded correctly, because there's bass on that record and it's fucking killer. It's really heartbreaking that they never got a good recording for themselves, but they were just incredible. And there were other punk bands too, and I didn't really care much for any of the other ones. They were the one for me. And I didn't really even like hardcore, just them. There's a couple of hardcore things I liked over the years. And to this day, now when I listen to hardcore, I almost love every hardcore I hear now. Like, it sounds better to me as an adult than it did as a kid. But like Bad Brains I loved, or, you know, there are a few things, but I didn't really like, you know, I like melody. It was always important to me. And I felt like State of Confusion had a lot of melody, even though, you know, it's hardcore and whatever, but it's had melody to me.
Even Septic Death, I find, has a weird melody to it. And I find that's a huge influence on State of Confusion, or at least that's what I'm hearing. Maybe it's, I'm just putting that on them.
I'm sure it was. They talked about them all the time. I don't think I have ever even heard Septic Death. I don't think I've ever even heard them.
Oh, you'll dig it.
Really?
You'll dig it.
I'm gonna check them out first thing.
There's actually recordings with Kirk Hammett playing guitar for him and James Hetfield doing like backing vocals on some of the recordings and stuff. And
I was gonna say, we just did some SOC just did some reunion stuff, and Tree People and SOC played together last week. Tree People just got done with this little 5-day tour and I think we're done. But I asked about, you know, I asked about Puss Head. None of those guys seemed to know what he was up to. I don't know that those guys were super close with him. They're a few years younger and stuff. Well, obviously 50 years of not seeing each other and shit. But.
Yeah, I think Puss Head's still around doing like the toy thing. And obviously there's a cult of Puss Head collectors that I think keeps him kind of doing that stuff. But every once in a while, he'll like wind up doing like a band's record cover, like a hardcore band's record sleeve or something like that. And it's interesting. You know, obviously the art he made had such a huge impact on the graphics of what, you know, punk and hardcore is. But, you know, I think Septic Death kind of gets overlooked at being this really shredding, sick band. And like, especially looking at State of Confusion as kind of like a continuation of that. Like, I think very different and a little more melodic, like you said, and a little more, but still it's like, it's almost like the Boise sound.
Definitely. There's no way they weren't influenced by that, of course. Yeah. Did you know Septic Death, is this all stuff that you've unearthed as an adult, or did you hear any of this shit or hear about this stuff young, or like where do they fit into your world?
It's weird. It's all like stuff I kind of learned. Obviously I put the pieces together a little bit more now, but as like a young person, it was all kind of like stuff that was just, you know, I think being blessed by getting into hardcore just at the birth of like having the internet at school or having the internet at the library where you could kind of go and have access and you could just research shit, right? Like Puss had a website called Puss Zone. I don't think he even did it. It was just like fans and it had interviews with him and like old articles he wrote for Thrasher and every record he ever put out or every record he ever kind of like did art for or played on. So it was just, you know, having these sorts of places and being able to dig, and then like, you know, like connecting the dots, like you're on Toxic Shock Records with the Tree People. Puss Head did the art for the first Toxic Shock release way back when, a compilation. So there's like, you know, I'm always fascinated by these connections, and you know, and like even Tad's connection to you guys.
Totally, you're right, and those connections are so interesting too. You know, obviously just pre-internet connections are so interesting because just the effort that people were going through, and just that there was only kind of just such a few amount of people that were really deeply involved in doing all this work.
But the connections are so deep. So I was like going into this, I've checked out Tree People, but then obviously before this interview, I've got some Tree People records. I mean, but like I went and listened to everything and just fell kind of completely in love with Tree People. And then in researching it, finding out that there's a connection to Diddley Squat. And then I hit up Nate from Foo Fighters and I'm like, oh my God, Tree People and Tiddly Squat connections. This is mind blowing.
Christ on a Crutch. We played with Christ on a Crutch a lot. That's a good hardcore band.
A killer band. And also so underrated or forgotten about weirdly.
Yeah, that was a big hardcore band for me too. We, you know, as far as, like I said, not a whole lot I listened to, but they were a big one too.
But that's interesting to me because like that LP on Toxic Shock that you guys did, to me, that sounds like a hardcore record in the same way that I look at, you know, like I Spy from Canada or, you know, like some sort of like mid-period 7 Seconds stuff or Quicksand. Like it doesn't sound like this stuff necessarily, but to me, that's a hardcore record.
Yeah, I've kind of felt that way too. Yeah, so SOC kind of fell apart a little bit. And in the ruins of that, I was friends with those guys and got them to play, you know, they kind of switched instruments. Wayne went from bass to drums. Pat went from singing to bass. And neither of them had played either of those instruments. So it's kind of like just brand new. And then I was much younger than those guys. So for me, it was like the most thrilling time of my life, you know, like my heroes inviting me in to like make music together. So we kind of were light. At first I played acoustic guitar. We were kind of rocking, but it was such a different thing. And then we recorded a single. I remember I got this review in some, God damn, what was that magazine? There's like kind of a big punk.
Not MRR?
It wasn't, it was smaller than that. But anyway, something that we all kind of thought was a good magazine. And they reviewed our single, our Tree People single, and said, college rock in the We Could Make It vein was the description of Tree People. And I was really like, that's a fair description, but it was also such a put down, you know, so like, you know, we're not trying to make it, but yeah, we were trying to sound like the, or to me, I was trying to sound like the Pixies or Dinosaur mm-hmm. or something. But then we all moved to Seattle and we just started practicing all the time. We just made it our life. And then we became a punk band again. We kind of, yes, they were a punk band. Then we made mellow music for a while, or, you know, not punk. And then, yeah, I feel like the same thing. I think that's like a hardcore record too. And then we kind of, the next record got a little poppier, and then I was out of the band and those guys became, you know, some other kind of thing. Not hardcore, still more pop, but anyway, whatever. That's sweet to hear though. And then, the thing I was going to say is that same reviewer reviewed the Gree record and he loved it. And I was so happy. The Guilt, Regret, Embarrassment record. I was like, oh good. This guy, I was glad to see this guy hear us again and hear what we were about. So.
Yeah. It's interesting because like it, as it goes on in those later records, it almost becomes, you know, like kind of a proto Midwestern emo kind of vibe to some of those things, some of those records.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, Scott's like he's such a rad singer. So yeah, I like a lot of that emo stuff was big for us too. That stuff is really huge, like Rites of Spring and, you know, Fugazi and, I don't know, a lot of, stuff that was called emo back then was, I mean, I thought that's what it was all about. Or God, was it like, what's the band from, Gray Matter? Yep. That was a huge band for me. Oh. Loved them so much.
First LP is unbelievable. That awesome.
Yeah, totally. And then the next record where they started to sound like, I can't think of Guy's band's name before Fugazi.
Oh, Rites of Spring.
Oh, that is Rites of Spring. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then they started sounding like Rites of Spring, and I thought they were great then too. When they took that direction.
I even hear like Dag Nasty in some of that Tree People.
Yeah, totally. Too. Yeah.
And like Hated, were you into that band Hated at all?
They're never
like,
heard of them.
They're like a weirder kind of like, once again, blessed by the internet kind of in that they were like a more obscure DC band and a little bit after the fact with Revolution Summer, but awesome. Like really fantastic. Numero Group did a reissue, I think, couple years back too. So
I'm looking into it.
It's fantastic. No, I've loved that. It's funny you say that about an important thing because that 7-inch is awesome. Like I love that record. And you list Tad as a spiritual advisor on that record too. So he's from Boise originally, right?
Exactly. And it was kind of like he moved to Seattle and kind of gave us a little bit of help. And, you know, he was just such a supporter of our band and music and the people, you know, he's just the sweetest guy. So yeah.
Did he have bands back in Boise or was it just Tad?
I first knew him. He played drums for a band called H Hour. He's a great drummer. And they were kind of like a funk kind of a, you know, like a, you know, punk funk kind of thing.
Big boys like.
Yeah.
Minutemen kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. More, I guess more new wavy than those things, but he's like that kind of drummer for sure.
It's awesome too, because, you know, for years I kind of wondered like, how did that Tad 7-inch wind up on Pusshead's label? And I guess it's like, that's once again, that Boise connection.
Yeah, totally. That's sweet.
Cause it's such a, it feels like, and it's interesting with Tree People, because I heard you in another interview talk about not really connecting with the grunge stuff happening and being mm-hmm. more kind of into the Seattle hardcore scene mm-hmm. And being part of it. And it's now, it's all parsed as being like one thing now, but the, mm-hmm. the minutiae differences between these different worlds, like, you know, something being considered college rock because it sounds like Dinosaur Jr. or Husker Du versus a band that's trying to sound like Minor Threat or the Bad Brains. It's just so interesting how now it's all kind of like looked at, because I guess streaming's really broken a lot of this down, but mm-hmm. as one kind of genre, but then it was like micro genres.
Totally. And it was so important back then to us for some reason, you know. Yeah. And it's funny how much we hated bands who sounded like the bands we liked, you know. a weird mentality we had, or I had. I don't know, you know. It's like, oh, those guys, you know, those guys sound like Dinosaur. I don't like them. I don't know what that's about.
Well, it's funny because like Nate when he was on the podcast from you know Diddly Squat and mm-hmm. and he was saying how he remembered seeing Nirvana at that Aurora Ballroom show, and Nico Case was at that show, and she was talking about how transcendent it was, and like when she was on the show, and then I was like, "What'd you think of it?" And Nate's like, "Yeah, you know, I checked them out for a second. I'm like, oh, they sound kind of like Nirvana," and I just shut the door and walked away, you know. And it's like, it's so funny because these were like major differences back then between these scenes, and like people that are your own peers, like you don't always relate to them.
It's such an age thing too. The age has so much to do with it. Like we recorded this record with Steve Lobdell, and he's just a few years older than me, and everything was like, we're just off on everything. Like he thought only the first Dinosaur record was good. I think You're Living All Over Me is good. He doesn't like Sonic Youth. You know, once Sonic Youth did like Evil, he was done with them. And that's like where they start to sound interesting to me. Buttle Surfers, he only likes the first record. I'm Hairway to Steven all the way, you know. It's like just like those little differences, you know. And the same with me. There's things that, you know, there's like a whole bunch of 90s stuff that I'm just don't give a fuck about. I don't want to trash talk anyone right now
on
the podcast, but, you know, bands that everyone seems to love that I'm like, nope, I miss that one.
It's interesting how, I guess there's like a flattening effect that time has on things where like people look at things as being a part of it, you know, like it's funny because Kathy and Toby from Bikini Kill were on the podcast and they're talking about the number of bands that get lumped in to Riot Girl. And mm-hmm. it's like, it was not a thing, let alone a lot of these bands would not want to be considered part of it because they were around way before it or just completely removed from it.
Totally. And I mean, and I think of that too, like bands from the 60s and, you know, we do the same thing with them, you know, yeah. I do. And it's like, well, those guys probably hated those guys. And those guys were probably, you know, like had nothing to do with, you know, such a, yeah, when you're in it, it seems so, I don't know, just a different perspective.
Well, and I think that's the benefit you get with age where you eventually, like you said, like now you can listen to all this hardcore and you love it. Like there's a, once you're removed from it enough where you're like, don't have this personal investment in it, you can kind of realize like, oh, it's all cool and it's all valid.
Totally. Totally. That's really like I love music and I love people that make music more than ever. And I love live music just more than ever. And I'm not, I think one thing when I was young is I loved music, but there was only certain things that really got to me, that really spoke to me. And then, you know, my mind expanded and then I was able just to appreciate more aspects and things about music. I think it is when you're young, you kind of want music to be a certain thing. You're like, I want it to be this, or at least that's how my mind worked as a young person, that I was like when I bought a tape, I had to like struggle to get into it, you know. It had to grow on me. Nowadays I can tell if I like something right away, you know, if it's worth it or not. And there's a lot of things that I think aren't worth listening to, but I'll find something in them to enjoy, you know.
Well, that's the thing, it's like, now how would you get into a difficult record? Because
why would you spend time with that when you could be finding something better, you know, something that makes more sense to you right away?
Yeah, something that immediately connects with you.
Yeah, for sure. That's true. And, you know, other than someone just making you do it, someone talking you into it. Or maybe they're just playing it for you and you don't have any control over the stereo.
Yeah, exactly. And then, like, or having to listen to something enough.
But that was always kind of, like, to me, a big part of, like, as a teenager, that was my understanding of music. Like, the good stuff is the stuff that it takes you a while to get into. Mm-hmm. You know?
Oh, definitely.
And that was the case. Like the stuff that I loved the most was stuff that I didn't like at first. So I don't know, maybe over time my brain figured it out, or I don't know.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So I guess, is it through State of Confusion? Or maybe it's Tad before that, but it seems like State of Confusion putting out the record on Subcore had a deep connection to Seattle.
I don't know that that really was much of a connection. I don't know. I never met that guy or anything. I don't think he wasn't really part of anything for us. I think he's just someone that we found to do that. But I could be wrong about that. Our connection to Seattle was Tad. Our main connection to Seattle was mostly just that Wayne wanted to move there. And we were like, oh, yeah, let's move. We'd like to get out of Boise, too. It wasn't even so much like to go and make our career in Seattle or anything. It was just like, let's get out of Boise and go to a cool city. And then also play in the band, you know. No one had any sort of illusions of like the band doing anything other than being fun, even though we worked our faces off on it because it was the funnest thing to do, you know. Practicing and working on it was what we wanted to do all the time, but no one thought that anything was going to happen other than we make records for our friends and our family, you know.
Well, it seems like you're also moving there just before moving there to make it was even something people would talk about doing, like you know, like at that point, it seems like it was a really different town. It must have changed so quickly.
Yeah, I don't know what my perspective was at that time. But yeah, exactly. People definitely just think that stuff because that was happening. Or people think that I moved away from Seattle because the grunge had exploded and I just didn't want to be around it or something. And none of that's true at all, you know. That's, you know, make music anywhere and, you know, live anywhere.
Well, it seems like also you guys were much more part of like a hardcore DIY scene, you know, like the Olympia stuff and all this other stuff that's happening Seattle's fascinating to me because, you know, obviously people talk about that grunge thing happening, but at the same time, there's this killer hardcore DIY scene that eventually gives birth to the Riot Girl and so much great stuff out of Olympia.
The Unwound and
Yeah. Like, and it's like, there's just so much stuff in Seattle around the same time as all the grunge stuff's happening.
Yeah, and we were just sort of like floating around, whoever would have us, you know. We had some friends that kind of played in kind of a straight rock band. We played bars with them, or we had some kind of straight edge kids that liked us in Bremerton. We'd get shows through them. We get throw shows with the hardcore scene a little bit, or even in a little bit of like the grunge scene too, still, you know, play with Tad or played with, you know, bands like that, Love Battery or something, some bands that were just kind of, that were more like the Seattle sound. So I don't know. We just kind of fit into different things. Flop. I don't know if you ever heard Flop. Do you know that band?
Yeah.
They're so great. We just played with the singer Rusty's new band. So Flop's been on my mind, and that was the band I thought was going to be like the band to make it from Seattle. I thought they were like the best band in Seattle. You know how it goes.
When you said Straight Edge Kids out in Bremerton, is that like Ben Gibbard and his friends? Because he was like a Straight Edge Kid out there, I think. Maybe a little bit later.
Really? No. None of these people, you know, they played in some bands and stuff. I can't think of any that you would know. I can't even think of their bands off the top of my head. They're just kind of some kid. Just, yeah, I don't know.
Because you wind up doing records on Battery Records for Greg Anderson's label. Would you ever play with Brotherhood?
Oh, yeah. Brotherhood. Wow. That's great. I never played with or saw Brotherhood, but Ron and I worked together at Kinko's.
Oh, rest in peace. A legend. One of the greatest vocalists ever.
Oh, really? Yeah, I didn't even know that.
Passed away a couple years ago. Maybe it was in last year. But
he was a really sweet guy. He and I got on really well. We were good friends.
Well, and just, you know, like Overkill Records, his label, put out like the first Integrity Records, you know, and such an
incredible... I never followed what he did, really, after I knew him in that time. So I haven't even thought about him for 30 years. But no, that guy was cool.
He afterwards he did that band Resolution.
Yeah, totally.
Which, yeah, it was on the same label as Galleon's Lap, which I guess you shared members with.
That's Greg's band, uh-huh.
Yeah. And Eric and played in it, too.
Greg was in some other band that practiced in our practice space, and that's how we met him. He, like, put out a Tree People single back before he had I can't remember what his label was called back
Battery.
Then. Battery. Oh, that was Battery still back then, huh?
Yeah, it's Battery.
I think his first or second release then was our Tree People record.
I think it is, because I think he does... Oh man, I'm trying to remember all the records on Engine Kid is on there, I know, and there's like maybe four or five releases, but yeah, you guys are one of them. And a great record too. Your record on there is awesome.
Oh fuck, thanks.
It's cool too how, you know, you look at, you know, like obviously music history talks about all these other bands from Seattle, but then you look at your guys' place in music history. You've got guys from Sun-O hanging out with dudes from Built to Spill, hanging out with guys from Brotherhood. And it's just such a, it's such a layered place for music.
Yeah. You know, it's just like this, what I was saying earlier about just like, there's only certain people that are into it. And when you're into it, you're so into it. And it was your life and it was your, you know, everyone's whole, you know, personalities and identities were so tied up in this stuff, you know? And it's I'm not saying that they aren't still now today, but you know, you had to really, you had to, you know, maybe I'm overestimating how much the internet makes things easier for people now or something, but probably makes it harder actually. I don't know.
I think it makes it. Yeah. It's weird to like think it. I think it's just different, right? Like there's obviously finding places to play and places to practice and live now is much more difficult. But there's also like this accessibility, but also, as you said, in the same time, everything's out there and you can listen to literally any song. So you're still fighting against the tide.
Just a different challenge, right?
Yeah. But it's still fascinating how it draws these kids that wind up doing interesting things in music and culture. Like it still is a place that I guess says you can do it. And people that are going to want to do it and have that drive to do it are going to find it and use it as a launching pad. When you guys get to Seattle, you know, it's before this Nirvana thing kind of explodes. What did you think of Nirvana?
I liked Nirvana. I wasn't super into it. I thought it was fine. I thought his voice was really good. And I was more, like I said, I was kind of more into pop. I thought it was too simple for what I liked at the time. I wanted things a little more complex for some reason.
Yeah.
If I moved there now, I think I would have liked Nirvana better.
Yeah.
Like I never really liked simple punk until I got a little older for some reason.
So who were some of the bands that you did?
I'm sorry. I just want to say it's so arbitrary. The things that I like thinking back to what I thought about things, I'm not like, well, this is how I felt. To me, it's like this kid that I was thought arbitrarily some weird thing, you know, and I still kind of feel that way, you know, like, I don't know.
I think you mentioned it before, though. It's that passion, right? Like this was stuff that was really important. Like you invested in finding it and the definition of it. And I think this is still the case too, but like it's like a religion, right? And your sect of this religion is the true sect and you know the true God.
Exactly. Dinosaur spoke to me so intensely that Nirvana was like, oh, that's cool. But this is going to my soul. Yeah, for sure.
Do you remember the first time you heard Dinosaur?
Yeah. And someone gave me a record. A friend of mine started a zine and SST sent him some records and he gave me a few. And so I only had, and it was like right after high school, I just got a record player. I was switching from cassettes to records. And so I had five records and that was one of them. And so I listened to it a bunch and I didn't really know what to think of it. It was like, it sounded really dissonant to me. It stuck out. It was You're Living All Over Me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, God, those guitar solos are so loud. And I listened to it every once in a while for like a month or something. And then one night I ate some mushrooms and listened to it and it just opened up because it was so perfectly like I was familiar with it. And I knew how it went. And then it was like, oh, now I'm getting this stuff. And then and that was my jam.
Yeah. It's funny how like Jay being Jay, not really like a drug guy, but at the same time, like he makes drug music.
Like it's, everyone does.
Everyone does. That's true. You know? Yeah. There's nothing like listening to Minor Threat high on mushrooms. It can be a bad trip, though. You could have Uncle Ian on your shoulder telling you, throwing your life away. Did Tree People tour much outside of kind of, you know, Seattle and Boise?
When I was in the band, we did just Northwest things. And then we did one West Coast tour and then one national tour. And that's all I did. And then I think they did a lot after that.
Is that when Toxic Shock had put out the LP?
When Toxic Shock put out the LP, we did the West Coast thing and we did the national tour after CZ put out our record.
That Toxic Shock label is unbelievable. Like when you go through the stuff that they put out, it's like incredible.
Really? See, I never paid much attention to it, but one thing about them is that they are cool. That guy, what's his fucking name?
Was it the guy who sang in, other band?
Was his name Bill something?
Maybe Peace Corps. He was in Peace Corps too, I think.
I didn't really, I never knew he played music if he did.
Was it Bill Warbucks?
That doesn't sound right. I can't believe I can't remember his name. Some Bill something.
I'll try and find it.
I don't think he played music. He had a record store. He was just the sweetest guy. He gave us back our record after a few years, just like that was his standard deal. We didn't know anything about it. He could have kept our record forever, but he made a thing where after whatever 5 years or something, the record reverted back to us. We were able to own it. So he's a cool dude.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, like who, like, speaking of people that passed away in Dinosaur Jr., his band, when he was in Decry, they put out an LP on Toxic Shock, like Man is a Bastard, the pre-Man is a Bastard bands were all on Toxic Shock, like they put out records from all over the world too. Like it's a really cool label, like a really, and the best Raw Power singles out on Toxic Shock too.
Wow.
It's cool. And also like the fact that, was it through Jack and Dino, I guess that connection would have happened?
I don't think it was. I don't know how it happened. That was all Pat, our bass player. He was kind of the manager person that made our connection. So I don't even know how he ended up hooking up with them. I think we might have just sent a demo to him. I'm pretty sure that's all it was. I think he responded to a demo, which is another rad thing about him. Bill, did you say Bill Musburger? Is that right?
Well, I thought Bill Warbucks is the first name that popped out to me. But I once Musburger? Again, that's just someone.
Maybe, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. I hope Bill doesn't hear this or whoever.
Correct it in the intro. I think, I think the fact that we're talking about this label is, you know, we're one of the few places that people are celebrating this label right now. So sure, hopefully appreciates that side of things. Because it's fascinating how much of this stuff kind of like goes into, you know, building this scene that winds up producing some of the most important bands, you know, like Built to Spill, like the Foo Fighters and Nate and stuff, like these bands that are kind of like hugely important to all music, but it comes out of these, like, you know, dudes putting out records in their basement or people, not dudes necessarily, people putting out records in the basement.
Yeah.
Did you guys serve a tour of Canada with the Tree People, or you played Vancouver, I know, later on, right, on the reunion?
Yeah, I don't think we ever poked our toes into Canada ever.
How far did you go on the national tour? Did you go to East?
I take that back. I'm sorry. I take it back. We did play Canada. We played Vancouver. Tree People did, totally. In whatever, 91 or something like that. 91 or two.
Did you notice a change in touring after kind of the alternative explosion happens? Was it easier? Some bands come on say it was easier. Some say it was harder afterwards.
I don't know that I had that good of a sense of the whole situation. I hadn't really toured enough to really understand that.
Cause it's fascinating when like this touring circuit that we kind of all follow is something that's grown out of punk and hardcore. But then you have these bands like, well, Paul, who you've done stuff with from Butthole Surfers, like Butthole Surfers that just like lived on the road and just, you know, seemed to like squat in town to town and kind of tour that by that existence.
Yeah, no, we were nothing like that. Yeah, I guess are you saying kind of like the DIY scene died away a little bit when alternative came in or something?
Yeah, it just changed. Like it seems like there was a, like some bands talk about how everything exploded. So there's more people coming to shows. There's a lot more coverage of what's going on. But then if you talk to people that were more on the DIY level or certainly DIY is a political kind of outlook, it wasn't necessarily a good thing. And it was a time of kind of like great strife within.
Maybe people seeing that there's some potential to make money off it or something. Yeah. Whereas in the past, it was just some kids or whatever, people renting a hall and just doing whatever they like, throwing a party or something rather than,
Did you guys get approached during that like period, Tree People?
By labels?
By majors and stuff?
No, CZ was the best we could do, which was, this is a whole other can of worms, not a label I wish I would have avoided. We tried to get on Sub Pop. Scotty went and talked to John Poneman one time, tried to get him to sign us and they wouldn't do it. Yeah, we were just happy to get signed anything, so we signed to CZ. But no, we never had any interest. I always felt like if Tree People had stayed together, we would have been bigger than Built to Spill would have ended up being. I think that we had a lot of momentum, and I think we were getting so good that we could have been like, you know, not the same level as Blink 182 or Green Day, but I think we would have rode the momentum of those bands a little bit.
It's interesting how, like, yeah, the sound that you have on that record sounds like something that could come out today, you know, and sort of resonate with where hardcore has wound up in recent years, you know, with the melodic kind of edge to it, but still that real aggression as well with what's going on. And it's interesting you say that, because like Brian Baker says the same thing about Dag Nasty, that if they were able to keep that first lineup together, they would have been as big as Pearl Jam. So you're a little more modest than Brian Baker's. But yeah, it's interesting how bands sometimes are just not for their time in a weird way. Like it's, you know, mentioned Seattle, like Seattle had a sound that certain labels were looking for. I'm sure Sub Pop by that point was maybe even trying to distance themselves from that sound. But whatever they were looking for wasn't what Tree People sounds like. Tree People sounds like a band that, you know, would have been on, you know, J Tree or Matador a few years later or something like that.
For sure.
Did you, at the end of it, was it just something where you felt like, because it is like sonically a departure what you wind up doing next. Did you feel like you were kind of like at when, you know, where Jay was when Dinosaur forms after Deep Wound kind of falls apart, or where Lou was, you know, where the sound just wasn't resonating with you anymore and you had to go somewhere else?
No, not at all. I was into Tree People. I kind of had some dereliction of duty because I fell in love and pursued that instead of music stuff, and kind of, you know, bummed out other people in the band who wanted to pursue the music super hardcore, and I wanted to pull back a little bit, and so they went ahead without me. But like the first, you know, some of the songs on the first Built to Spill records were going to be Tree People songs. You know, I'd written them to be Tree People songs, and you know, it was fun. And it was also fun and exciting to do my own thing, to be the main creative force in the band and make all the kind of musical decisions. That was a blast. And I was into, like, Pavement was a big influence at that time. Slanted and Enchanted, you know, to make some music that was more experimental, poppy, you know, just more weirdness, not tight punk, you know.
It's funny too, because like Pavement, you know, Malcolmus is another guy who played in a punk band prior to, right? Like a hardcore
band. Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. They were like, you know, the band The Authorities, they have that song I Hate Cops. Anyway, they were kind of like the junior band to The Authorities, is what.
Was he a singer, a guitar player?
He was a singer. But he said he used to go to, he said he went to the Gilman and he saw NoFX play there.
That's great.
I know. What an amazing confluence that would be.
We crossed paths with NoFX a few times. I think Tree People played with him a couple of times, and SOC definitely did.
Well, it's like an interesting point in music and punk at that, because it's prior to everything exploding and then resettling again. And there being like a sort of like a reestablished sort of underground scene, but everything's kind of bubbling up, and all these bands that would wind up exploding from their different scenes are intermixing with each other and playing together. It's so such a weird point to have Tree People and NoFX on bills together. But I guess, I don't know, maybe it's like the there is like a quest for melody and a love of whatever definition of hardcore each of you had.
For sure, totally. I always loved NoFX. I never listened to their records, but I always loved seeing them.
Nate told me Greg told him he wasn't allowed to wear a NoFX on stage shirt on stage with Brotherhood.
That's sweet.
This has been awesome. And I've really appreciated it. Dude, this has been, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on here and do this, because I feel like Built to Spill is such a legendary band and you never really get talked about as being from this hardcore scene.
Oh, it's sweet to talk to you. It's so cool just to hear someone talk about State of Confusion and just have them validate it, you know, like someone that wasn't around for it, that's interested in it and appreciates it. Like, that means so much to me, just hearing you talk about those guys.
Well, I think that's the other problem that kind of happens with this scene is that so much stuff gets canonized, and we tend to look at certain scenes which had the benefit of either huge labels that he eventually built themselves into huge kind of brands for this thing or access to big media. But Boise's kind of cut off from a lot of that sort of stuff. So a lot of these bands, unless they got out, don't really get talked about as much. Except to Geth, you know, but totally, that took Pusset being, you know, it took Pusset being the graphic designer for everybody to kind of, I think, give Septic Death part of its shine.
Well, that's what upsets me so much about those SOC recordings. I just wish that there was just this real record of what they really were about. But you know, that's how that happens. They're lucky to even be recorded at all, I guess. You know, because that took a lot of doing. You know, to get your hardcore band into a studio in Boise, Idaho, took a lot of doing, you know, scraping together the money, trying to deal with these engineers that don't have any idea what this music is you're trying to make. You know, there's just so many, and you know, and not having any blueprint at all. You know, that was what impressed me about Pat and, you know, SOC and the Tree People guys, was just, you know, booking shows and making posters and all this stuff. There's no blueprint for it, you know, just figuring it out. And it was cool that they cared enough and that they just had the imagination and tenacity to pull it off. I was just along for the ride. I was just a music person. As far as all this other DIY stuff, I was useless and I wasn't pitching in much money or anything. So I appreciated so much what all these other people were doing to make music happen for everybody.
Well, you know, being there in Boise talking to people, it seems like Tree People are kind of the band that kind of like built a lot of the stuff. Like people talk about the band, obviously Built to Spill as well, but with such reverence and such, you know, like the importance of that band. And it seems like that kind of comes out of State Confusion very directly in a way too.
100.
Was Silence your guys' label?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. It was SOC's label and then became ours a little bit. And it was kind of, you know, something you throw on there if no one was putting it out.
You guys should just re-release all that stuff then, or it should just be re-released or remixed or something. It'd be so sick to have that out again.
There's a little bit of stuff going on. I know they did re-release the SOC record, the A Street, the 6.3 million acres. Their first record actually doesn't sound too bad.
No, I love that record. That record's amazing. Yeah,
6.3 million acres is okay. A Street is a great album, but you can't hear it very well. A Street, check it out.
A Street's the one on Subcore, right? I think.
Yeah, that's the Subcore one. Yeah, exactly.
That one also got crazy distribution. Like that was, you find that in Toronto used all the time. Like
it that's cool.
And I think because it looks, the cover looks a little weird. Like it looks like a late era SST record or something. Mm-hmm. So I don't think people give it the chance, because when you put it on, that thing goes.
Yeah. It's so good.
Well, this has been so good, Doug. And anytime you want to sit down and talk about music with me, Jay Mask is not giving me your number, be damned. You're always welcome.
Damien, that was really sweet. I appreciate it a lot. Really, I was just so flattered when I even heard that you wanted to talk to me. I didn't, when I saw you guys play, I'd already heard you guys. A friend of mine who had turned me on to some of the best music of my life, like turned me on to the Wipers. He's a guy my age. He turned me on to just, like, whenever he said something was good, it was good. And he hadn't turned me on to anything in years. And fucked up. He's like, this is like, it's like hardcore, but it's like good, smart hardcore. You should check it out. And I just loved it so much. I was so excited to see you guys play and was so, loved it so much. Loved all the Mountain Dew you poured on your head or whatever the fuck happened. It was such a fun show. So when I heard you wanted to talk to me, I'm not a podcast guy, but I was like, fuck yeah.
Well, thank you for the compliment, but did you ever get to meet the Wipers? That's crazy. Were you a fan of the Wipers?
Yes. I never saw them play or anything, but our drummer for a long time, Scott Plouffe, his brother played drums for the Wipers like in the 90s or whatever. And they lived in a compound together in Tempe or, you know, somewhere in Phoenix, Arizona area. And so we would stay with them when we were touring. And so we met Greg. He was really cool. He was sweet. He came and watched us play and was like, had nice things to say about us. And he even built a compressor for me, or a preamp for me, because he's building stuff, a tube preamp that I bought from him. And I haven't seen him in 20 years or something, but yeah, that band's one of the greatest ever.
Absolutely. And it's funny because, you know, we talked about Nirvana, like talk about a band that, you know, I think influenced Nirvana in such a sonic direct way. When you hear the Wipers, you're like, oh, that's one of the key influences going on here.
Yeah. I heard the Wipers on the radio last night when we were driving into town, from driving all day from Bellingham, Washington. And, my girlfriend said it sounded like the OCs. I was like, yeah, it totally sounds like the OCs. Like it was Romeo Rome.
Like if the Wipers were from England, they would definitely be a band that would be on the cover of like Mojo or Uncut. Like they're like a band that sadly just kind of gets glossed over by everything else. But oh my God, those songs.
Oh yeah. But anyone who's heard them loves them. I don't know anyone that's heard them that doesn't love them.
Yeah. It's one of those things that like you're that guaranteed.
Voice, such a cool voice. Those guitar tones. Yeah. Everything about them is just so perfect punk.
It's just like a part of the American songbook. Well, this conversation will go down in the Canadian songbook of great podcasts. And Doug, I can't thank you enough for doing it.
A pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you, Doug, for coming on the show. When you heard right there, Doug will be back for a part two at some point in the future, because there's a lot more to talk about. We talked a lot longer off air too. So that'll happen. You know, that's the thing. It may take a long time to happen, but they do eventually all happen on Turned Out of Punk. Speaking about things that are going to be happening on Turned Out of Punk, on the next episode of Turned Out of Punk, one of my favorite guitar players ever from the band Richard Hell and the Voidoids, from just a legendary, like I'm one of the greatest of all time. Ivan Julian will be on the next episode of Turned Out of Punk. And believe me, we find out some cool connections. This is going to go places that, I certainly didn't expect it to go. And you'll hear that on the next episode. Well, that's it for me. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues faced by Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights and stop hate and violence directed towards people of different faiths, different sexualities, different races, because what we're talking about here are not political issues. These are just basic human rights issues. People deserve to be able to live free from fear of hatred of violence. No one deserves to have to worry about this shit. So, and I would also add to this, we need to make sure that people have the right to choose what they want to do with their reproductive systems. So if there's organizations that are affecting positive change in this world, get involved. And, you know, if you can lend your money, maybe lend money. If you can lend your time, lend some time, lend your support, and help affecting the change you want to see in this world. Speaking about changing things, get involved and create culture in punk, because anyone can do this stuff. Start a band, start a fanzine, start a podcast, maybe not a podcast. Do something, and it'll make, make the punk you want to see. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them, and they can really help someone else live a very long and healthy life. So sign that card. I've seen it provide miracles for people. I guess the organs itself didn't perform the miracle, but the organ transplant person performed a miracle by providing that organ to that person. Oh, boy. And try meditating. Because I didn't believe in it, and I find I use it all the time now. So maybe it'll work for you too. Well, that's it for me. Thank you everyone for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode. Bye.